accession number 27747, Reel 4.
Graham Pitt, Reel 4.
Then on the 11th of December, Rear Admiral Robert Lindsay Burnett came aboard with his retinue. And this, is, of course, was always a bad sign because admirals like to go to sea and cause trouble. So we received him with mixed emotions. But as it happened, he was a jolly good bloke, and he's one of the, I think, about the only admiral that inspired me to say clearly to myself, this is a man I could follow. He was a very outgoing personality, jolly, and, as I said, a good bloke. He cleared lower deck and said, you know, we were going to Russia, and, no, he didn't. He said, last night in the starboard hangar you were singing, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. You lucky people, you're going to have one. So there we are. Incidentally, what I'm going to talk about now is given in written detail in Warship World, Winter 1994 issue on page 22, and it's called Worm's Eye View. So, we set off, and as far as I can remember, the journey out was quite uneventful. I think I remember being on the upper deck and watching the aurora borealis in the sky. It was rather like great searchlights with sort of ribbons of light. I'm glad I've seen that. And we put into, well, I call it the Polliano Inlet, but it may be the Venga Inlet, on the 24th of December. And I remember going on the upper deck as we were going in, and there was a black beetling cliff to the right with a red light all behind it, and I've never seen a crueler coastline. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we anchored, and because next day was Christmas Day, the Jamaica had brought up some turkeys for us, and these were shipped across, and somehow or other she lost a couple of men doing it, which was very sad, but the turkeys tasted none the worse for that. We had also got three barrels of beer in the starboard hangar, which had been under the surveillance of a marine sentry all the time. We wondered who kept an eye on the marine sentry, but there we are. So for Christmas Day, the signallers produced flags, and all the mess decks were decorated with flags. I went to collect our beer in the mess fanny, trying to forget that leading writer Mallet had been sick in it at 48 hours before, and drew our beer. And on the way back, I met the captain, and who was smiling all over his face, and Rear Admiral Burnett, who was saying that did me a power of good. So we really had a very nice lunch, and after the lunch, I went along to the cook's mess, which was next door to us, and said that in our family it was always the custom on Christmas Day to thank the cooks, and they'd done us very well, and thank you very much. And some of them came from the Gaubles and got those well, and you know that they were really tough characters. They all sat there looking pleased as punch and blushing prettily. But I said this, you know, without any eye to the future, but for the next few days, we've almost spent nights fighting cocks too, because the cooks shared their goodies with us. They used to bring their food back to the mess deck covered in sort of greaseproof paper, so you knew they weren't doing themselves too badly. and I think we had the same treatment for a bit, but I didn't do it with that in mind. It was just, you know, custom. Well, then that evening we had, the writers were invited into the gun room by the gun room officers for a drink, which was very nice. We had to go to action stations at 2 o'clock because the Germans always sent over a reconnaissance plane about that time. I was troubled by this because I didn't want my best suit to get mucky, but anyway, I went down to the handing room as usual, all passed off peacefully. And then in the evening we had the sort of song and dance team of the Russian White Sea Fleet on board, and they gave us a concert and a show. And, one chap sat on his hunkers and did kicks and so on, which was really spectacular. I have a vague feeling someone else spat daggers out of his mouth or something. But anyway, it was a good show. And at the end, we all sang the Red Flag. Not that I expect the Ruskies thought that we were riddled with communism, but actually we did it to annoy the commander, who was thought to be a conservative. And I think there was an attempt at fraternisation afterwards, but of course language was a completely difficult. One of the Ruskies knew a little bit of German, one of our chaps knew a little bit of German, but there it was. Now, aside from that, we had in the crew one ordinary seaman, Romanov, who I know had a relation who was a Grand Duchess in Highgate, because I looked at his service certificate. And he was down in our action station for a bit in the early days. Down there he read economics, and I read Gone with the Wind, which seemed appropriate among the explosives. Anyway, while we were up in Murmansk, he was in great demand, you know, ordinary seaman, Romanov lay aft for this, you know, pipe several times, and he acted as interpreter. But I've often wondered how he must have felt to be back in a country where at one time his relatives held absolute sway. He was a nice chap.
So he was definitely part of the...
Oh, yes, I think, yes. We used to call him Rosie because he had a pink and white complexion. But there was some correspondence, actually, about 3 or 4 years ago in the Times about the Romanov family. And I wrote to the lady who originated the correspondence to try and find out, you know, where he did fit in and, if possible, what had happened to him. I forget the details now, but he did survive the war all right and settled in the United States, I believe. Well, there's just interpolating one thing. Reverting to our time at Spitsbergen, while we were there, Lieutenant Flavel, who I think was an RMVR, who I think was an estate agent in civilian life, took some photos of the sort of seashore at Barentsburg, complete with the works which had been sabotaged, just in case it would come in useful on the next trip. And when these had been developed, they were laid out on my desk in the captain's office and pieced together, and in due course were sent ashore to the powers that be. About 40 years later, I went to the public record office to try and find out one or two facts about operations that the Sheffield had been involved in, and judge of my delight when out of the archives of the public records office came this photo, which had been pieced together on my desk. I was rather pleased with that.
Wonderful.
Yes. Well, round about we sailed from Murmansk to the open sea around a lot of sort of around an S bend, and it was a cruel landscape. Mm. Then the 29th, it must have been, we. Well,
was it icebound at this time?
Yes. Well, you mean in the water?
I mean, yes.
I don't remember anything in the water. No, the ice age doesn't come right down. There's always open sea there, or has been.
But were the decks iced over?
Yes. Mm. Yes, you had to watch that because the top weight could cause a capsizing unless you were careful. And, of course, the ice interfered with the mechanism of the guns, so they had to be kept ready all the time, or cared for. About the 29th of December, we went to action stations because we were then nearing the two main German bases. There was Altenfeld, where the German fleet was, Bardufoss, where the Luftwaffe was, so one needed to be a bit careful. But you see on films, you know, if there's an air raid coming, the crew scampering about, preparing for an attack. Well, that's all balls, because if you've got a proper ship, you've been at action stations for hours before that. Mm. So we went to action stations at about 2100 as usual on the 29th, and we just stayed there until tea time on the 31st. We're now coming up to the Battle of the Barents Sea, on which some books have been written. 73 degrees north by Dudley Pope is probably the best, I think. But anyway, I remember our lot came out of the Cordite handing room two decks above and had our breakfast in the flat on the deck just underneath the quarter deck. And I don't know if it was sixth sense or what, but I suddenly felt I'd ought to be down in the handing room. But I went, and no sooner I got there than I got a call on the intercom saying from Walden, who was the captain steward, saying, load the hoist. I'm always quick on the uptake. I said, load the hoist. Yes, load the hoist. Oh, I said, OK, well, I'll give you flash bliss. So by this time, all sorts of bodies were tumbling down the hatch, you know, our crew and the seven in the magazine. And they had received a scare up there, or sort of stand to or something. So we took the doors off the hoist and started sending up the charges. Not a thing that one wanted to do lightly, because if they went up top and weren't fired off, you had to bring them all back again, which is tedious because they had to go down a different route, you see. But anyway, in the best traditions of the service, we did all this at 9 o'clock, then bugger all happened. Until about 11:30, when we hadn't a clue as to what was happening, except that we got a bit of news down the telephone. They said D-17 had reported a hit forward. D-17 was the senior officer of the 17th Destroyer Flotilla, and that was Onslow. And it was rumoured that the Nuremberg and the Leipzig, with two German cruisers, were around. Well, I know by Jane's fighting ships, I thought, they're smaller than us, we'll sink them and get a bit of cheap glory. But in the event, it didn't turn out quite like that. Anyway, all was quiet until 11:30, when we could hear the guns begin to start woofing up top, and the hoist began to rotate, so we started loading the flashless in. I haven't seen much about the use of flashless cordite, but we certainly caught the Hipper, which was a heavy German cruiser and far bigger than the Leipzig and the Nuremberg. Having I worked out the other day that, having regard to rate of fire, her broadside was about 2.5 times ours. On paper it was worse, but we could fire our guns quicker because the 6-inch guns can be have the produce handled by hand, whereas she would fire a 250-pound shell and that had to be mechanically handled, and of course that slows you up. Mm. And of course machinery can go wrong, I have to say. Anyway, 2.5 to 1 I think is probably a fair thing. And of course an 8-inch shell if it hits you is far more destructive than a 6-inch shell if it hits them. Mm. But anyway, we just got their range, and the captain told us afterwards that he saw the orange glow of a hit on the Hipper. When, and again this isn't in the books, our radar crew, who was headed by one able seaman, Parkinson, picked up an echo of a destroyer, something approaching us. And that turned out to be a German destroyer. You can tell German destroyers in case you ever bump up with one, because they have their funnels fire wide apart, whereas ours are closer. And it is said that we switched target from the Hipper to this destroyer in 40 seconds, but that has been disbelieved by many critics. And AMV turrets started bashing her. I think they hit her with the first salvo and then with the fourth. And she drifted down our starboard side, and the 4-inch got at her, and the pom-poms got at her. Then X and Y turret, which was our lot, got at her, and we left her a wallowing wreck astern with her stern under the water, and all the rest on fire. So there were no survivors from that lot, but I've seen from German sources that she had thought that we were the Hipper, in fact. The destroyer behind realised that we were an English cruiser. They said, "Das ist ein englischer Kreuzer." But by that time, it was too late. Mm-hmm. So we took care of her in about 2 minutes. But it was a cruel business. But I mean, it's that, that us or them. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was close enough to have torpedoed us very easily. So...
that's interesting that you found that out, yeah.
Well, because what had happened was that the Hipper and the Lützow was, oh yes, that was a pocket battleship like the Graf Spee, and she fired an even bigger shell. She had 11-inch, which fired a 670-pound shell. But one had been on each side of the convoy, and they were going to compress it and slaughter it. But it didn't work out like that because we got in the way, and the destroyers, including, the Onslow with Captain Sherbrooke, kept them apart. And when we appeared, I think that firstly, while they were actually engaged, they got a message from the German command saying, "Don't take risks." And, of course, when we appeared, they didn't know how strong we were and all the rest of it. So there we were. But, you see, we undoubtedly caught the Hipper by surprise. And if we were using flashless cordite, they must have had sort of 12 6-inch produce falling about the ship. And where the bloody hell did they come from? But I've never heard anybody take up this flashless business. Anyway... actually, from the standpoint of the cordite handing room, it was harder work because you had to send up two cases for each shell. Mm-hmm. So you had to be pretty quick. And then when they were exhausted, we went back to normal full charge ones. Yes. And that was just one per shell, so the life got a little easier. But when
so
we
you
went,
used the flashless. At the beginning.
Yes, that's right. And I know when we changed over, the John, who was the PO writer in the Cordite Gallery, rang down and said, "What's the delay?" And I said, "We're changing over, we're doing our bloody best." And then I rang off, and then I immediately sent a note into the magazine cursing them. So there we went. But I passed it on, but not officially. Anyway, for a few minutes, we were really working quite hard. And this is bullshit, but I must remember very well putting in the prodigy in the hoist and slapping the door and saying, one for mother and one for father and one for me and that one for my blighted youth. And oddly enough, I suppose, you know, you were just in a box and you couldn't see the ship railing around you, which is one advantage. But on that occasion, I wasn't frightened. Mm. I have to say that, having confessed to cowardice on two occasions.
Well,
I was angry.
I don't think fear is cowardice, is it? It's
well,
normal to be.
But I was angry because I remembered my mum with the bomb going overhead. I thought, stop them, I'll get those bastards. So there we are. But anyway, this went on for a bit, and then the hipper of the loot cell disappeared, and we followed them for an hour or till about 13:45, and that was it. You can look at the, you know, track charts of all the ships now, but in fact, no one knew where the others were. The convoy we were supposed to be protecting, we never sighted. I don't think anybody knew where they were. Partly, I think, because it had been a bit delayed by a storm and it was further to the west than it should have been. But anyway, that was... We then...
So which month was this?
This was 31st of December 1942, which I celebrate with one or two mates on the phone then, every year.
Do you?
Yes.
Do you
still? Oh, just say 31st.
Who are they? Who are your mates? They were on the...
Well, the Fred Ladd was one of them. He was my chief mate. He died about 18 months ago. There's Chick Fowler in Southend, who's still alive and kicking. We can probably identify them later on. At round about tea time, I crawled out of my handing room and went to the pay office. And the electric wiring, which is used to be in channels attached to the bulkhead, the deckhead, was all down, you know, festoon, water. All the doors off the cabins have been blown off just from the action of our own guns. We haven't been hit, it was just the vibrations. Anyway, I got my mug and I had a shave, and I think that's the best shave I've ever had. 3 days of puppy fur, you know. And then we went back to Scapa, and I don't know that we were cheered in, but we were rather pleased with ourselves. And the Admiral Tully, who was the CNC home fleet, came on board and said that he thought he could spare our services for a few days. So we went down the Minches to Glasgow. And of course...
Oh, finally.
Yes. The writers were up till 2 o'clock in the morning preparing, you know, ration books and pay and all the rest of it. Then, of course, I went down and flew, didn't I?
Oh.
So I missed my leave.
Oh, no.
But, and so did another Marine. But anyway, that was...
So you were in the sick bay?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. So there we were. And I got out of the sick bay and returned to duty just as we were slipping down the Clyde. So that was sad. I never got that extra 72 days of rankles yet. But anyway, we went back to Scapa for a change, and we did another trip with the Anson, the battleship, acting as distant cover for the next Russian convoy. The one I've been talking about was JW-51B, so this next one was JW-52. And then... We went back to Scapa for a change.
So this was up to Murmansk again, was it?
No, sorry. We were distant cover, which meant that you just sort of patrolled up and down a few hundred miles west of Spitsbergen. just in case something big came out.
Right.
I think really they were completely useless, so of course there was not near enough. There was distant cover for us in the, when we were scrapping with the Hipper and the Lutzow, but, you know, they were in no position to intervene at all. Incidentally, I should have said that although the Hipper was also, I think, hit by Jamaica, which was our chummy ship, and when she got back to port, various bulkheads and things gave way. And the result was that although she went back to Germany, she never went to sea on an operational mission again. I think she mucked about in the Baltic, but not in the wide Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, that was good,
yeah. Yes, so it was a lucky thing, that was. Well then, reversing to 52, we got back to Scapa. And then, of course, we were browned off for close escort for JW-53. And this time we got about 12 hours sailing off Iceland. And that's all. In those days, actually, it made a bit different now. There was usually a belt of rough water, but you had to find your way through. And on this occasion, it was a full hurricane. And if you're conservative, you say the waves are 50 feet from crest to trough. If you're about right, it's 60. And if you're drunk, it's 70. But I reckon it's sort of 55 to 60 is about right. And this was quite serious, actually, because the waves were so big that our bow wasn't lifting clear of the water, it was just hammering down all the time. So against the possibility that her spine would break, all the foreign mess decks were evacuated. We, of course, were parked out in the pay office of midships as ever. We had tried to do some work on our ledgers and ended up in the scuppers because their chairs just couldn't keep any balance. So what do? You go to sleep, which we did. But anyway, come lunchtime, or dinner time, I suppose I should say, I thought I'd better go forward and get some, you know, plates and knives and forks and things, which I did. And Fred came with me, and he stayed on the first deck under the forecastle, and I went down and got the bits and pieces, but the sides of the ship were thrumming away like anything. It was pretty odd. So anyway, we got back. But in the event, the keel held, but all the anything that was movable on the upper deck was removed. All the boats were smashed. There was depth charges, which we kept against submarines, they were swept away. The A and B turret forward were trained to starboard to stop the water going up the spouts, the barrels of the guns. And one sea came in and bashed in the side of the turret. The next one took the roof off. So, you know, that was 1¼-inch armour plate. So it was really quite hectic. Mm-hmm. But, we couldn't go to war with only three turrets, could we? So we went back to Scapa, and then we went down to the Clyde for briefing.
So what month was this?
This was March 1943, I beg your pardon.
Have you ever been sick during these episodes?
Had I been sick?
Yes, have you been sick?
The only time I've actually brought stuff up was, I think, in September 42, which was the first time we'd been to Iceland and we went through that belt of rough water. And I was sick then. And as I said, I was in the captain's office then and you had the wiggly tail, which didn't really help. But another time, I felt sick, and I don't know why, but I was down in the handing room at that occasion. And I said to myself, I'm not going to be sick. And the sweat poured off me, but I wasn't. And while all this was going on, no, that was all right. But may I be perhaps a little scatological? I found that the movement of the ship did upset my bowels. And there was one occasion, perhaps it was over the storm, I don't know, when I didn't do Big John's for 5 days.
Oh, dear.
Yes. But, I think it was partly the diet, because it was pretty dry stuff. I mean, I live on all bran now. The most that you could get was Weetabix. Do you know Weetabix?
Yeah.
Yes, it's rather dusty stuff. Don't go much on it. And I do remember that when we got back to Scapa, I felt my stomach sort of loosening up. You know, it's been like that.
So you've just been holding on to your stomach all that time.
Yes. Not very consciously, but it was there. Mm-hmm. I hope I haven't made you blush, but you know, you ask for detail and no one else will tell you that. I hope they don't have to either.
They can make life misery, can't they?
Oh, yes, yes. Anyway, we got to... I told